support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and gardening supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners. Open year-round, Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and 907-235-8777. Additional support comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In downtown Homer and on the web at wodabotanicals.com. Hello and welcome to Homer Grown. My name is Desiree Hagen, and for now, I live on a micro farm in Fritz Creek, Alaska. For this episode contains multitudes. I talked to Dave Ianson, who is the soil conservationist for the USDA NRCS in Kenai. And Nicola Revelo has your weekly rundown of events and opportunities in local agriculture. Musicians, do your thing. Okay, so Nicole tells me that I am the only person that knows what the Haber-Bosch process is. That's not true, but in talking to others, I realize that not many people are familiar with it. The Haber-Bosch process is super important. I was recently told that I was mispronouncing the name by Frank von Hippel, who is a professor of environmental health sciences, and he also produces the Science History podcast. It's Haber. So thank you, Frank, if you're listening. So Fritz Haber is a very controversial figure in the chemistry world. He was a German Jew chemist who was working mostly during World War I. He is considered the father of chemical warfare after his work developing poisonous gases used on the Western Front. Like, think mustard gas. So Fritz Haber worked on Zyklon A, which was a pesticide made from hydrogen cyanide. So if that name sounds familiar, it is, because Zyklon A was a predecessor of Zyklon B, used in the gas chambers, which later killed several members of Haber's family and relatives. Remember, German Jew. So there's other stories related to Fritz Haber and why he is such a controversial figure, but I want to tell you about the Haber-Bosch process, which is what Fritz Haber actually won a Nobel Prize for. So in a nutshell, it's a way to convert atmospheric nitrogen into ammonia using large amounts of energy. So energy intensive, in fact, that the process accounts for 1.4% of global carbon dioxide emissions and consumes 1% of the world's total energy production. The ammonia, or the byproduct of this process, is primarily used for synthetic fertilizers and secondly for explosives. So what you need to know as a listener, when we talk about the Haber-Bosch process, we're talking about synthetic fertilizer. So instead of trying to explain the nitrogen cycle in a few sentences or get into the weeds about the chemistry involved, I'm just gonna let Dave Ianson explain.
Okay,
so let me just start by having you introduce yourself.
Oh, okay. My name is Dave Ionson. I'm a soil conservationist with USDA NRCS in Kenai, Alaska. I have a PhD from Oregon State working with mycorrhizal fungi and actually plant microbe interactions, how mycorrhizal fungi affect other organisms in and around the root system. And then my master's was using mycorrhizal fungi to kind of jumpstart revegetation on disturbed sites like mine sites. I actually worked on Mount St. Helens also.
You mentioned mycorrhizal. Are there different types of fungi?
Yeah, there are fungi that are beneficial, which are called mutualists. There are fungi that are detrimental, which are the parasitic fungi. There are fungi that break down rocks. Of course, there are fungi that are strictly there to decompose organic matter. All kinds of different fungi. In fact, there are 7 different types of mycorrhizal fungi.
What are mycorrhizal fungi?
It's from the Greek. The word literally means fungus root. And it is a mutualistic, so it's a beneficial, mutually beneficial relationship that plants had to enter into about 465 million years ago. Mycorrhizal fungi are responsible for plants coming out of the water and evolving up on land. Mycorrhizal fungi are in, well, the mutualists are in lichens. You know, they allow algae to come up out of the ocean and form with fungi and form lichens. So that's the first, some of the primary colonizers of the land.
And you had mentioned that there are 7 types. What are these 7 types and what distinguishes them from each other?
There are some that are what they call ectomycorrhizal fungi, which are mainly outside of a host. And those are the ones that we know the most about because they're the most visual ones. Those are like the amanitas that we see in association with trees. So they form partnerships with conifers and birches, oak trees, those types of, well, firs and hemlock and dug firs and all kinds of what are called gymnosperms or just naked seed plants. So all of our economically valuable forest trees or paper trees are all ectomycorrhizal associated. And then there are endomycorrhizal fungi, which are the, like the arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi. Those are the ones that are in about 350,000 species of plants. So it's a lot easier to say which plants on Earth are not mycorrhizal, because normally about 90% of all plant species are in nature mycorrhizal. And the ones that are most economically beneficial as far as food are all endomycorrhizal, these AB type fungi, the internal to the host. And then there are the mycorrhizae, the orchid mycorrhizae, which are endomycorrhizal, and they affect all the species of orchids. And then there are arbutoid mycorrhizae, which are responsible for the growth of madrones and arbutoid species of trees, like what you see in the chaparrals down in California. Those madrone trees are all mycorrhizal. And then there's the iroquoid mycorrhizae, which are responsible for the growth of our blueberries and our lingonberries, all of our iroquoid species of plants that we get our berries from. And then there are some that are mycorrhizal fungi that are responsible for the growth of like lupins. And then there are, oh heavens, there are some that are called endomycorrhizae. In other words, they have morphological, or they have structures that are part of both outside and inside the host. And, oh, geez, I'm trying to remember all seven different types. But for the sake of farmers, the most important ones are the arbutoid, the AB mycorrhizal fungi that are endomycorrhizal fungi that occur on most of our food crop.
And what did these, did you call them butyl?
Arbutoid.
Arbutoid.
Yeah, the AB stands for arbuscular, and arbuscles literally means tree-like structure. And these tree-like structures are internal to the host plant. So let's say that Desiree has a tomato plant, and she looks into the root of that tomato plant, and right along the part of the tomato plant that carries water, which is called the stele, S-T-E-L-E, so that's the vascular tissue in the root system. All along that vascular tissue, you'll see these little tree-like structures inside the cells of that tomato plant. And those tree-like structures are the exchange site where mycorrhizal fungi bring in nutrients from the surrounding soil. And they take these nutrients and they put them in these arbuscules. And then the arbuscules transfer them right straight into the vascular system of the plant. So arbuscule just means tree-like structure. The arbutoid mycorrhizae are the ones that have the little tree-like structures inside the host plant.
Yeah, like the word arbor or...
Arbor Day, yeah.
Yep. Okay, if you were thinking of a description of what the mycorrhizal fungi do... Like maybe they are like a bus or like a transport system. Do you have a good analogy for?
Well, the one that I think of and the one that's most important, especially from the standpoint of soil health, is that mycorrhizal fungi serve as a conduit. Like you have electrical conduits in your house. Well, if you can think of a conduit that's inside your house and outside your house at the same time, so what goes to the outside of that house or what goes to the outside, the transport that mycorrhizal fungi do is sugars, carbon. They provide, that conduit provides sugar for the organisms that are around the plant host root. And so what comes in to that conduit, so it's a two-way system. It moves in both directions. What comes in that conduit are minerals, water, all kinds of nutrients, especially, well, the one that's looked at the most is phosphorus, because mycorrhizal fungi can actually break down rocks, rock phosphate that the plant cannot get on its own, and the mycorrhizal fungi break those rocks apart and transport that phosphorus right into the plant. And of course, phosphorus is one of the most limiting nutrients that we have.
What do you mean by the word limiting?
Well, there are three nutrients, what they call macronutrients, that are needed in a very, very large amount. So the primary one is nitrogen, the second one is phosphorus, and the third one is potassium. So the plant is most limited in its growth by nitrogen, and secondly, it's most limited in its growth by phosphorus, and the third most important one is potassium. So if you don't have enough phosphorus, your plants are not going to grow.
And phosphorus usually comes from rocks?
Yeah, it comes from the mineralization or the breakdown of rocks. It also comes from organisms that die, like you and I. Our DNA is a phosphorus backbone in our DNA. So when we die and are, you know, decomposing, we're releasing that organically bound phosphorus into the soil also. Unfortunately, plants cannot take up organically bound phosphorus, so microorganisms in the soil have to convert it into a form that the plant can use.
Well, first I wanted to say, so if I die and I was buried, just stuck in the ground, I would not be of value to a plant that, you know, that was planted on top of myself, because unless there was mycorrhizae.
Or other organisms that are in association with mycorrhizae. There are bacteria in the soil that are what they call phosphorus solubilizing bacteria that happen to hang out with the mycorrhizal fungi. The mycorrhizal fungi, remember I was telling you that there's a conduit, and so the organisms in the soil, they can also live off of sugar that comes from the plant. It comes out through the mycorrhizal conduit, or right around the root system, which is called the rhizosphere, which just means it's an area that is affected and affects the root growth. So around that rhizosphere, you've got all these organisms that occur inside these glued together sugar aggregates, soil particles that are glued together by sugar that comes from the plant through the mycorrhizal hyphae and into the soil. And inside those aggregates, you've got all these organisms that are living. I mean, there are, like I said, there are phosphorus solubilizing bacteria. There are other organisms that break down nitrogen and take it and put it back into the atmosphere. There are other organisms that take nitrogen, which has to be in a certain form also. So not only could the plant not use your organically bound phosphorus, but the plant cannot use your organically bound nitrogen. So if we just sat in the soil and there were no microorganisms, a plant couldn't use us at all, and we'd just sit there.
So you talk about this network as a conduit. I'm just making sure that I get this correct. So It's, you know, transporting sugars to the organisms, and then it was sending back some things as, you know, it breaks down these organically bound compounds, it transports things like phosphorus or nitrogen?
Correct. I mean, I look on it myself as a garden, literally a garden that we've been given the task of taking care of. And one of the things that we have to be able to do when we take care of this garden is that we have to understand that all these organisms, it all works in consort with one another. No organism lives in a vacuum, and that includes human beings.
How can we help these mycorrhizal relationships flourish?
I think the first thing is just understanding that these interactions are going on. Let's say Desiree is very into synthetic fertilizers. And even synthetic fertilizers, you have to realize when you are fertilizing what you think you're fertilizing your plants, you are not fertilizing your plants. You are fertilizing the soil. The soil organisms convert what you put into the ground into a form that the plant can use. And I think understanding that is the rule, that is the fact, I think goes a long way to understanding that we are part of a system. That's the beginning, is understanding that plants need to have compounds or need to have nitrogen and phosphorus in a certain form, and these organisms are responsible for it. I mean, the Darwin Society came out with a list of the most important organisms on Earth, and human beings, we didn't come up in the top five. We were number six.
That doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, these organisms came out, well, earthworms came out number one, but these other bacteria and fungi came out above us in importance. And I think understanding that is the first step. And especially with organic farmers, people that want to stay away from synthetics, I think you have to admit that you're going to have to become an amateur microbiologist. And you're going to at least have to understand that you are not fertilizing a plant. You are fertilizing the soil. And I think that's extremely important. And from the standpoint, and this is kind of where I come around to NRCS, is that NRCS has become a champion for understanding what is called soil health. And I try to tell people, you know, as we treat the soil, we treat ourselves. We have to understand that we need air. Okay, the soil needs air also, just like we do. We need water. The soil also needs water. And we need nutrition. The soil needs nutrition also. And that's the only way to keep a sustainable system going, is to understand that there's this big cycle going on. I think that's the most important step. I mean, you don't have to learn every little thing. I mean, it's overwhelming for you, and it's overwhelming for a lot of people, but I think just admitting and understanding that the rule in nature is these interactions. Your plants don't sit out there in a vacuum all by themselves. And I think that if people could admit that and start to act as if they were treating a pet or an animal, you wouldn't abuse your pet. You shouldn't abuse the soil. And that includes depriving it of oxygen or depriving it of water or depriving it of nutrition.
So I had a few questions. Just okay. to go back, you had talked about the importance of certain organisms, and you said that humans were the sixth on the list. I'm wondering if insects or pollinators were on the list.
Insects and pollinators are on the list. They were just a little lower than number six. I mean, from a standpoint of pollinators, and this is another area that NRCS is helping financially and as far as knowledge, helping farmers, is realizing the importance of pollinators. I mean, if we lose our pollinators, we've lost a third of what we put into our mouth as nutrition. I mean, just the fact that earthworms are number one in importance. You know, when you're a kid, you used to, well, some people stepped on them, or they took a spyglass and tried to fry them, and then you're starting to learn that earthworms are very intricate to the whole system. Here's an organism that's really small, but is a lot more important to the earth than we are.
You had talked about synthetic fertilizer, and I've been kind of reading about the Haber-Bosch process. I'm not sure, but I was wondering if you could just elaborate on your views about synthetic fertilizer.
Well, synthetic fertilizer, especially Haber and Bosch, we're going back at the turn of the last century, where Fritz Haber decided, you know, that what we needed to do is to be able to break down nitrogen into a form that the plants can use. And so what they do, well, my take on the Haber-Bosch process is that it served a purpose. It got us past a point, but now we are beyond that. And we have to realize, one of the things that we have to realize is that the Haber-Bosch process is extremely energy intensive, because you have to raise. So what they're doing is they're taking this nitrogen that we're walking around in, you know, 79% of what we walk around in is atmospheric nitrogen. But the plants cannot use that because it is two nitrogens that are triple bonded together. So the only thing that can break up that bond is lightning, and that's because lightning is 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And this Haber-Bosch process, which has to raise the temperature extremely high also in order to break that triple bond. And what comes out of that triple bond is ammonia, NH3. And then so we can turn around and take ammonia and put that on the fields. But like I said, it's a 15-to-1 input output. So imagine that it takes 15 tons of liquid natural gas in order to raise the temperature up to produce 1 ton of ammonia. And then you take that 1 ton of ammonia, and this comes back to this fact that plants can't take up certain forms. Plants cannot take up ammonia. They can only take up ammonium, or they can take up nitrate. And so somewhere along the lines, this Haber-Bosch produced ammonia has to be converted again by microorganisms, nitrifying bacteria. They have to convert it, and ultimately it winds up in a form that the plants can use. So for me, the Haber-Bosch process, it is good for what it does, but you also have to realize that the stuff you're putting on the soil, the output of the Haber-Bosch process, still has to be converted by microorganisms. So to me, it is a non-sustainable in the long run. It's non-sustainable synthetic fertilizer. It works for what it does, but you cannot depend upon it in a sustainable fashion. And then, like I said, you still have to rely upon these bacteria to convert it into a form that the plants can use. You know, the other output of the Haber-Bosch process was weaponry. Ammonium nitrate, as Timothy McVeigh pointed out to the American public, is extremely explosive. And that's how the Green Revolution came about, was after World War II. We had all this ammonium nitrate, and we had these plants that were geared up to produce weapons or to produce explosives. And somebody said, well, you know, this stuff that explodes also will ultimately feed the plants. The problem is, the more of this synthetic fertilizer you put down, the stupider you make your plants, and the more you dumb down these organisms. Because they don't need the organisms per se, and so the organisms start to go away, especially the nitrogen-fixing bacteria are inhibited by all of this nitrogen that we're putting down. And so that's kind of my version of the down-low on the Haber-Bosch process.
So is this why certain people talk about how, you know, they try to analyze what happened during the Dust Bowl, and I know that it was a combination of different things, but could the contribution of this process contributed to the decline of soil health during this time?
Well, it added to it, that's for sure. I think the biggest thing with the Dust Bowl, and that's where NRCS came about, we were born out of the Dust Bowl, and that is realizing that our cultural techniques, especially this tillage, going in and tilling and tilling and tilling over the long period of time, destroys your soil. I mean, it destroys the organisms, because you've got organisms that have evolved for hundreds of million years in the dark and also evolved in these aggregates. And you come in and you turn that soil over, expose it to UV irradiation, the sun, and these organisms can't take it, that and you've gone in with your tillage and you've destroyed their home, the place where they live in these soil aggregate. Yeah, I think fertilizer had part to do with it, but I think our cultural techniques were as important, if not more important, in the evolution of the Dust Bowl.
So I'm going to go back to the NRCS. What programs does the NRCS have to encourage soil health specific to these mycorrhizal relationships?
Well, you know, as a mycorrhizist, and I've been a mycorrhizist for 40 years, mycorrhizists have always said, you know, that it takes a while for the public at large to come along and understand this stuff. So it's also taken a while even for NRCS to kind of admit that this stuff is where it's at. We have to understand soil health because we can't continue to do things the way we have done them in the past. So the programs that we have as far as soil health, we actually have an EQIP program, which is Environmental Quality Incentive Program, where we will provide not only financial help, but also technical help to farmers and to growers in order to foster these sustainable subsurface systems for our soil. So we have nutrient management that we help farmers with, where we're trying to keep them from putting too much phosphorus on, which hits their pocketbook and also ultimately can wind up in the Gulf of Mexico, not so much here in Alaska, but in the Midwest. Overapplication of fertilizers has really wreaked havoc. And so we have that nutrient management. We also have conservation crop rotation, where we try to get farmers to keep from putting the same thing in the same spot over and over again, which allows pathogens to get in. Like if you plant potatoes in the same spot over and over and over, you're going to eventually wind up with late blight of potato. So, and then this conservation crop rotation also allows us to help farmers put in nitrogen fixing plants like legumes that form these associations with bacteria that can take nitrogen out of the air. That was the third way of producing nitrogen fertilizer one of them was Lightning, the other was Haber-Bosch, and the third was biological nitrogen fixation, which is what these bacteria do. And so we're helping farmers put in plants that will recharge the nitrogen in the soil. We help with pollinator habitat, and we help with cover cropping. Because one of the mistakes they made in getting up to the Dust Bowl was they did not cover crop. And you really should keep a living plant root on your soil as long as possible for the year, because these organisms, that's where they live, in and around the root system of plants. So you come in, you harvest your garden, and instead of just leaving it there bare to the elements, if you came back in and put in kind of whether it's a grass type plant or a plant like, well, another legume like Austrian pea. We're running some cover cropping trials on the peninsula, of course, but you put in different types of plants, and these allow the soil to, number one, it keeps them from overheating when the sun beats down on them, and that also tends to fry these organisms. So this cover cropping, which is one of the things that we do, allows you to keep a living root in the soil as long as possible. So we've got cover cropping, conservation crop rotation, nutrient management, soil health, buffer zones, so that if you do wind up getting some water erosion, it won't get a chance to build up steam. It'll go through a buffer zone that you put, like you put between your garden and Kachemak Bay. So that turns around and catches the soil and any excess nutrients. So there's all these things that NRCS does that is there to help farmers keep more money in their pocketbook, keep their soil on their own land, and make their system sustainable.
So as you were talking, I had a couple follow-up questions. You talked about the excess of phosphorus that goes into the Gulf of Mexico.
Oh, yeah, that happens.
What's
happening now?
What effect is that having?
Well, what that does is it winds up in these algal blooms in the soil, or this big proliferation of organisms that require oxygen. So there's this biological oxygen demand of organisms that are in water bodies. And if it all gets taken, if all that oxygen gets taken up by these algae that are the result of phosphorus washing into the water, then you don't have that oxygen for other organisms like salmon or fish, bottom dwellers like crayfish and lobster, all these different organisms. So you essentially wind up with a section of water that has no oxygen in it. It's all been used up by these organisms.
You know, you talked about these three ways of adding nitrogen to the soil, you know, lightening, the Haber-Bosch process, and nitrogen fixers. And I know that peas and other legumes are nitrogen fixers. Are there any other plants that serve as nitrogen fixers?
Yes, there are. And that's, to me, that's one of the, it's a fascinating, awe-inspiring situation, because that whole process, biological nitrogen fixation, has to take place in the absence of oxygen. So the organisms that do it, like the ones that are inside of a pea, they can, that nitrogenase enzyme that breaks down atmospheric nitrogen into ammonia, that nitrogenase enzyme is destroyed in the presence of oxygen. It has to be bathed in what's called leg hemoglobin. And leg hemoglobin, just like hemoglobin in our bodies, carries oxygen. And leg hemoglobin carries oxygen away from where biological nitrogen fixation is occurring. And because of that, these pea nodules will actually bleed if you cut them open, just like you and I will bleed hemoglobin. They will bleed hemoglobin. Okay, having said that, and having said that this has to occur where there is no oxygen, there are organisms that live right next to the root system, and they live in these, what they're called, low oxygen tension mucigel. Mucigel is just a bunch of carbohydrates and exudates that occur right next to the plant. And these mucigel does not have a whole lot of oxygen in it. So that's where these, what they're called, free living nitrogen fixers, they get inside that mucigel and they do their job inside there. So you don't necessarily need a pea plant for a free living nitrogen fixing organism to exist. Like I said, there are seven different types of mycorrhizae. There are two big types of nitrogen fixers, the ones that are internal to the pea plant and the legume, but there are other nitrogen fixers that are right around the plant root that don't need to have a pea.
And just so that I'm understanding, these are ones that operate anaerobically or without oxygen?
Correct. They have to, because of that nitrogenase enzyme that is responsible for the breakdown of atmospheric nitrogen, because it will not work. It is destroyed in the presence of oxygen, you have to have an anaerobic situation.
I'm not
sure. Does that make sense?
A little bit. It's a new concept for me.
I mean, you've hit it on the head. It has to happen anaerobically. So let's say Desiree has a rhizobial bacterium in her body. Desiree can fix nitrogen. Well, that rhizobium has to be inside Desiree's body in a place where there is no oxygen. So most of Desiree hopefully has oxygen going to it. So if you've got to find a place that's anaerobic on Desiree, you've got to transport the oxygen away from where Desiree is fixing nitrogen. That is what happens with legumes. Now, let's say Desiree has all this mucigel, which is like this jelly type stuff around her body. It covers a layer of her body that's about 2 millimeters thick. And so it's just this big gel-like mass that's on top of you. Okay, that is not inside your body per se, but if that mucigel, that jelly-like substance around your body, does not have oxygen, then these free-living nitrogen fixers can get in there and do their job. And therefore, Desiree does not have to be a legume for these free-living nitrogen fixers to work.
I have to say that I both love and hate the fact that you used my body as the example.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I tried to make the analogy fit, you know. I do not want to preach to people, but the word Adam means earth, and the word Eve means good. So you put Adam and Eve together and you've got good earth or good soil. It is fascinating, the root of these different words. You know, every time I think about the subsurface ecosystem and every step you take out there in the woods, you're stepping on over 300 miles of fungal hyphae, of fungal roots, hyphae being analogous to roots. So imagine that. It's just mind-boggling.
The hyphae is the root of a mushroom.
I say for all intents and purposes, it's analogous to a root on a plant. It's a lot smaller in diameter than a root, but it is the root of a plant. The mushroom that you're seeing above ground is like the apple of a tree. So if you can imagine underneath that little mushroom you look at, that's especially if it's mycorrhizal, you've got the biomass of a tree underneath it.
Is it also sort of like the brain?
Yeah. I'll say that. I mean, somebody's going to nail me for it, but it works like a network. There's been a lot of research lately into plants communicating back and forth through fungi and through the roots. Mycorrhizal roots, they will fuse together. It's a term called anastomosis. And so these different trees can fuse together with other trees, and they are communicating back and forth. And I was down in Mexico doing research for the Mexican government, and I was looking at the connections between nitrogen-fixing shrubs and cacti, because they're both mycorrhizal. And if you can imagine a nitrogen-fixing shrub fixing nitrogen and passing it to the cactus, and so these cacti are little nurse plants to this nitrogen-fixing shrub.
Meaning that they are taking the nitrogen from it?
Yeah. It's the nitrogen-fixing shrub is what we call mesquite, what the Mexicans call mesquite, and it fuses with a cardone cactus, and the little cardones always grow right next to the mesquite. We were down there researching whether or not mesquite was passing these nitrogenous or nitrogen compounds to the cactus.
You had said that you had been a mycorrhizist for over 40 years. You know, for somebody that maybe is, you know, in college right now and is interested in this field, what does your job entail? What do you do? Where has it taken you?
Well, it's taken me to work on Mount St. Helens. I worked on a National Science Foundation grant. We were observing that the first plants that came back after Mount St. Helens were all mycorrhizal. So we found that pocket gophers were transporting the seeds of different plants and the mycorrhizal seeds or spores. Also, they were transporting them in their fur. And so all of those were all mycorrhizal. I kind of got into mycorrhizal fungi because I was a disturbed area restorationist. So I was involved with revegetation of mine sites, like coal mines, gold mines. I worked on a Superfund site. But what I did was I worked at essentially jump-starting the plants coming back, which is a term called succession. I was jump-starting succession by reestablishing the subsurface ecosystem around the roots as quick as possible. And the reason is, like, a land on a coal mine is extremely screwed up. It doesn't have any structure anymore. The pH is about 3.9. It's just really inhospitable. So you've got to, in order to allow plants to survive and be sustainable, you've got to reestablish that subsurface ecosystem around the roots. And so that's what I was in charge of doing. So I started getting into that. And then up through my PhD, I started finding out that it's not just mycorrhizae in the plants. There's all these other things that are down there in the soil that interact with the plants. And then from there, I worked in Montana as a native plant expert and director of research, and I was working on mycorrhizae, like I said, to jumpstart these disturbed sites. And I think that that's one of the things that is going to be around for a long time, especially if we keep disturbing sites. We're always going to have the need to revegetate them. And so those are the areas that I kind of finally pursued. And then I worked for the federal government up in Alaska with the gene bank, establishing native plants and characterizing their growth. Of course, you find out that most of the successful native plants are all mycorrhizal also. So I guess if you want to get to the basis of the success of land plant, you basically can't overlook the ecosystem, the microbial ecosystem that is around the root system.
So you had mentioned that the soil in the coal mines, you know, sometimes would have this pH of 3.9. You're focused mostly on the health of the soil, but were you witnessing any other effects environmentally or maybe socially that these mines had? This might be political.
I'm going to get in trouble from the mine industry, but, you know, whenever you're taking the top of a mountain off to get at the coal and you've stockpiled all that topsoil without living roots, it all dies. And so that's an issue that they've had. Of course, you've got a lot of, when you don't have soil structure, you don't have anything holding the soil down. So the soil in Wyoming wound up in Nebraska. You know, we always laughed about that because it's like, why put the soil down in Kemmer, Wyoming, when it's going to wind up in North Platte, Nebraska? So we were working at trying to keep that soil in one place. So there's a tremendous scar upon the land that coal mining does, But to their credit, they have hired people that are biologists rather than engineers. And the biologists have helped the engineers and vice versa to realize, you know, this it's important to reestablish the subsurface ecosystem in order to get the above ground ecosystem to work.
So one more question. You mentioned the arsenic-loving fungi that would appear in this area where there was mining. Do you know of any studies or any places that are using the mushrooms in this way?
Well, not necessarily mycorrhizal fungi. I mean, I've done it, and there's some other people that have done it. There's some folks in Colorado that have been doing it forever. And there are folks overseas in France that have been doing it. But they also use the decomposing fungi that are not mycorrhizal, that they use Pleurotus austriatus, which is the oyster mushroom, and they just poured oil, engine oil, into this Pleurotus pile or Pleurotus-laced soil, and the oyster mushrooms just went crazy. They could not get any more oil to drip out of this pile. They are using fungi along those lines. I used them on a Superfund site down in Coalinga, California. I used mycorrhizal fungi on buffalo berry to keep asbestos fibers out of the Coalinga River, because the fungi hold soil in place, so you don't get so much water erosion. So they're doing it with that kind of stuff. Basically, anything that has a hydrocarbon in it can be cleaned up by fungi. They will just eat hydrocarbons like crazy. So gas spills, oil spills. And I've just recently found that there's some research being done on mycorrhizal fungi and fungi to mitigate radioactive material, which I didn't think could ever happen, but, you know, they're starting to do it. So who knows? Who knows what the future holds?
Is there anything that you want to add, or anything that, I mean, this is a giant topic and we talked about a lot of things.
Oh, but yeah. Well, like I said, I think the most important thing for gardeners and farmers and anybody that wants to grow plants for food and fiber, I think the most important thing to remember is that you are not fertilizing your plants directly. You are feeding the soil, and the soil microorganisms turn around and convert everything you put into it into something that the plant can use. I mean, I was raised to believe you just throw fertilizer out and you're fertilizing the plants. Well, it does not go to the plants. It goes to the soil microorganisms, and they, in turn, feed the plant. So I guess that's the one statement I would like to leave everybody.
You know, it's funny you said that, because in the process of doing the show, every year I feel like there's a theme or there's like a big revelation that sort of comes to me personally. And the first year, the revelation was kind of that in my way of gardening and how I view gardens and farming in general, it was like, if there's a problem, you know, you have one thing that you use to solve that problem. Like, oh, my soil isn't healthy. Well, I'll just throw something on it. But in reality, it's a holistic view, instead of like, oh, there's something in my body that's bothering me, so I'm going to take this pill or this medicine in order to solve it. Whereas a different way of looking at it is, I'm going to take care of my body and myself so that I don't have those issues in the future.
Yeah. Well, you realize that there are more bacterial cells in your body than there are tissue cells. So you're a walking ecosystem just like I am. You have to approach it holistically.
Am I more bacteria than human?
Yes, you have more bacterial cells than you do tissue cells in your body.
Well, thank you so much. I'm not sure if I don't know how
I'm not
to.
Not sure if that's good or not.
There's a book that I've wanted to read. It's called I Contain Multitudes.
So, there's a book you should read. I was thinking about the history of soil, and there's one called Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations by David Montgomery. And that's a good one to look at the history of soil degradation.
Ooh, I like the sound of that. I'll put it on the expanding list of books I need to read. By the way, I'm always looking for a book. That interview was with Dave Ionson. Had that recording in the bank for a while. That was recorded September 21st, 2001. Coming up next, Nicola Revelo lets us know what's happening in the world of agriculture.
Hi. I'm Nicole from Homer Soil and Water with this week's roundup of news and tidbits on local agriculture and wild habitat too. First up, a job announcement for people interested to work on developing local food in Alaska. The Alaska Farmers Market Association is hiring a local foods coordinator. This grant-funded position will coordinate both special projects and the day-to-day aspects of the Alaska Farmers Market Association as outlined in a 3-year grant from the USDA Farmers Market Promotion Program. There is potential for growth in this position. The coordinator will work with the support of Cook Inlet Keepers Local Foods Program, the Alaska Farmers Market Association Executive Director, Board of Directors, and project-based coordinator. And this position is meant to help Alaska's local food system flourish. You can find out more about applying on the Alaska Farmers Market Association website. This next one is for local farmers or would-be local foods producers. A new guide for USDA assistance for underserved farmers and ranchers is now available. It is geared towards those considered traditionally underserved by federal farm assistance programs, specifically veterans, beginning or limited resource producers, ethnic minority producers, or women producers. This booklet was created for you to learn about assistance and targeted opportunities available to you. It includes programs offered through the Farm Service Agency, Natural Resources Conservation Service, or NRCS for short, and the Risk Management Agency. The guide is also available in Spanish, Hmong, Korean, Vietnamese, Thai, and Chinese. Find it online on the farmers.gov homepage in the news section. The University of Alaska Cooperative Extension has 2 online workshops about food preservation coming up: Making Sauerkraut and Relish on October 11th, and Making Wild Game Sausage on October 18th. To register for either of these virtual workshops, visit www.uaf.edu/ces and scroll down to the bottom of the homepage for the upcoming events roster. And lastly, if you are a person producing hay or gravel and are interested in learning what it takes to become certified weed-free, you can learn how on the Alaska Division of Agriculture's website. Just look for the page for the Plant Materials Center. The staff at the Division of Agriculture to contact is Dan Coleman, and Dan can be reached at 907-745-8721. Happy harvest season, y'all!
That's our show. Questions and comments can be directed to Desiree, that's D-E-S-I-R-E-E, at kbbi.org. I've been your host, Desiree Hagen, reminding you to support your local farmer. Support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and gardening supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners. Open year-round Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and 907-235-8777. Additional support comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In downtown Homer and on the web at wotabotanicals.com.